My name is Paul Price, and I'm honored once again to chat with Mr. Andre DeShields for the Actors Fund on Sunday, November 13th, 2016, at the Yale Repertory Theater in New Haven, Connecticut. Oral history 2 of 3. How are you, sir?
I'm very well and happy to welcome you, Black, part 2.
Good.
Yeah.
Good to be back. So tell me, so talk to me a little bit about how do you feel about working in different media, film, television, theater, and which of those you prefer, and how does it affect the way you approach the work?
My métier is the stage. It's where I feel most alive, most effective. It's also where I feel most loved, and that certainly is one of the incentives for my being in the arts, because I want to be remembered. I want to be in the consciousness of a people, which, by the way, is also paying off in great rewards in terms of the process I'm going through now with 7 guitars, in terms of the consciousness of the people. The theater is also a warm context. You can actually feel the temperature in the temple, if you will, either rise or lower, depending upon what the material is, depending upon what the emotional investment is, depending upon how close the performers are to the spectators, depending upon the intimacy of the venue. You can feel the temperature of the environment change. Also, there is this very magical word. We don't hear it used very often, but it is exactly at the heart of the stagecraft experience. And the word is ephemeris. The theater of all the media, the theater of all the mediums, because that's what we're talking about here. Not the media in terms of television journalism, but the mediums, the agencies by which we practice our craft. The theater is the most ephemeral. Your experience in the theater is like a bubble. You blow the bubble, and you know its lifetime of existence is finite, because then the bubble bursts, and it's gone. But the little time you spent blowing the bubble and enjoying the bubble was paradisical. Had all kinds of happiness, all kinds of the of emotional terrain to which you could invest yourself. So that's where I am most content. That's where I am most fulfilled. And that's where I am most effective. I'm something of a novitiate when it comes to television and film, if those are the other two mediums you're talking about, right? It isn't that I haven't done any television. I've done those guest stars, those episodic gigs. It's not that I haven't done any film. But those two mediums, television and film, are fast and cold. I don't mean to say that there is no emotion involved. What I mean is, I'm going back to the temperature in the room. The temperature in the TV room and the temperature in the film room is cold because of the equipment that's involved. And it's very difficult for the human fever to heat things up. Which is why when you do TV and you do film and you see the results of your effort, it's very often totally different than what you thought you were investing. Because the relationship between the director and the actor at the end of the day is heavily influenced by who's editing the film. I say that I'm a novitiate because those are the two mediums that I still pursue auditions for. I don't have a name, I don't have a track record, I have experience, but there's still so much I need to learn, I have to learn. I evolve slowly. I'm a tortoise, I'm not a hare, right?
So can I ask you, in terms of the theater, in terms of contemporary plays, musical theater, Shakespeare, more classical text. Of those, what floats your boat?
Check this out. I have always considered myself an actor, a capital A. When I came to New York in 1973 as an actor, because I am a black man, in audition situations, the casting director would ask two questions: can you sing, can you dance? And my response was yes and yes, although I'm not formally trained. But I'm from that era of race people that if you couldn't sing and you couldn't dance, then you ain't black, right? So yeah, I could throw down, and that's how I achieved my profile in this industry, as a song and dance man. But in situations like this, when people want to know, and so I can disabuse them of these assumptions that I have a 4-year training background at Juilliard or Yale or NYU or something like that. No, no. When you see me dance and when you hear me sing, I'm acting so convincingly that you think I'm a dancer, that you think I'm a singer. What I am is a hell of a great actor. Having said that, I'm now at that part of my journey where it is the dramatic impetus that gets me to unfold more readily. Because it requires a deeper investigation of myself. It causes more immediate and better growth. And because on my learning curve is what I should be doing now. I have 70 years of life experience that, in the hands of the right director, can be enlightening, entertaining, and exciting.
So as coming off of that, one of your great works was In the Wiz. Right?
Yes.
That a lot of people still remember you.
Yes. If I were to drop dead in your presence right now, I've made my mark. Right.
Right.
I am remembered. I'm in the memory of this industry, if for no other reason, because of having created the title role in that game-changing, precedent-setting, history-making musical 41 years ago now. And it's been, there's been an attempt to replicate it in film and on live television. But the source is still the 1975 Broadway musical that opened at the Majestic Theater on January 5th. And that makes me a progenitor, that makes me an ancestor, that makes me an explorer, an inventor. Because after that fact, many people have acquired employment because of the work that we did in 1975. When I think that in the film, Richard Pryor played the character that I created, I say, hey, I'm making work for Richard Pryor. And on television, Queen Latifah, I mean, let's get really modern about this, played the role that I created 41 years ago. That's very satisfying in terms of sustainability and longevity. And those are the two indicators in this industry. You can be brilliant, you can be a genius, but if you're just a flash in the pan, if you don't last, if you aren't perennial, if you don't recur, if you don't come back, then what is it all about? It is our responsibility, it's our duty, and it's our destiny to leave a trail, to blaze a trail and leave a trail that other people following in your wake can discern, can smell, can suss out.
Good. And
before you, may I interrupt you? I'm glad you mentioned The Wiz, because this week I did two interviews in terms of promoting the show. And of course, I'm thinking of nothing but August Wilson, Seven Guitars, and the journey that we are all on. And like a bolt of lightning, a piece of The Wiz fell into the middle of the man-to-man, one-on-one interview I was doing at lunch with Chris Arnott from the Hartford Current. Now, can I take a pause because the cornbread is smelling done? But I'll get back to that.
Okay.
I'm ready. Yeah. As I was getting my instructions from the company manager about where I would meet the head of marketing, where I would be meeting the interviewer, etc. You might know this place. Do you know the study on? Well, that's where we have the interview. It was pleasant, you know. It was very pleasant. And I love walking into a situation like that, and the maitre d' walks up to me and says, "Ah, Mr. DeShields," and I'm like, "You know who I am?" "Oh, yes." You know, they set it up. And then they take you to a lovely table, and then in the middle of the meal, he comes by and says, "Oh, I just wanted to let you know that everything has been taken care of." I say, "Yes, I arrived." I'm up here in White New Haven. Did I say that? Come on, that's okay. Don't be censoring anything. So it's the interview with this gentleman, Chris Arnott, of the Hartford Current. And he says, "You know, we've met before." And I said, "Well, forgive me, I don't recall." And he said, "Well, in 1993, you were doing a national tour of The Wiz, and then bang, it all came back. I'd come to New Haven for this experience with August Wilson's 7 Guitar, saying to people, I had never worked in New Haven before. And when this Chris Arnott mentioned that, a whole vein of memory and a whole flood of memories washed over my body. And it was so important because it made me understand why, having been here in 1993, was not on the tip of my mind, or in the Rolodex of my mind. And it was because I was mourning the death of my life partner. He had died in June of 1992, and I was racked with sadness and didn't know what I was going to do with myself. And as if the gods were listening, the telephone rings, and it's George Faison, who is the Tony winning choreographer for the original Wiz, 1975. This is June 1992. And he says, "Andre, we've been invited to open the National Black Arts Festival in Atlanta, Georgia. And they want a revival of the Wiz. I have not done a revival of the Wiz since doing it in 1975. And I didn't immediately say, oh yes, George, I'll do it. But the two things that convinced me that I had to do it, that I must do it, one, the offer of the billing. It put me and Stephanie Mills above the title. And I thought, yeah, I deserve this. I worked my way all the way up to above the title. I like that. So that's an incentive. But the reason I must go is because it will take my mind off mourning my beloved. And the tour started the very next month. It took me back to Baltimore, which is where the show opened initially, so I could be in the embrace of my family. It took me to other places, but it brought me here to New Haven. And in the program, by the way, as if he needed evidence or proof that he was correct about my having been here, the interviewer brought the program from that time in 1993. And as you can see, it's in mint condition. It's so important because when I wrote my bio for that particular program, I encrypted the name of my lover in the bio by writing the narrative, but then in each line of the narrative, I would capitalize an alphabet so that by the end of my bio, it was spelling out his name. Now, it unfolds even more. When I submitted that bio, I got a letter from Playbill saying, we cannot print this bio in this condition. Now, I suppose that they were hopeful that that was going to be the end of that. But they didn't understand. I was mourning the loss of my love. So I responded to them, why can't this bio be printed this way? And then they explained that they don't do encrypted messages in their bios. And I responded to them, can you show me somewhere in your constitution or bylaws that this bio is unfit for printing? And that's when they acquiesced. Because they were just telling me what they didn't want. They weren't telling me that it was illegal or anything like that. So it got printed, which helped to alleviate some of my sadness, because wherever we went, in all of the cities we went, people would look at it and go, what is this? And even if they couldn't figure it out, they would know the name of the man I'd loved for 17 years. And I've never had the urge to do anything like that again, which is why I fought for it that one time. I wasn't trying to rebel or make a revolution or change their protocol. I needed to remember him that way. And I needed the people in the communities that I would be visiting in the show who knew about that relationship, that he had gone. So that's part of the indelible, that's part of the indelibility of The Wiz. Other than being a history-making, precedent-setting, game-changing musical, it gave me an opportunity to heal from a wound that I still carry. But at the time it happened, I thought I was never, ever going to overcome it. It also reminds me, now that The Wiz is no longer a surprising event, people don't remember how defiant that musical was. In 1975, to have taken what was an iconic, classic that was the exclusive domain of Judy Garland for 60 years, and it had been adapted from an American fairy tale that totally excluded any demographic of color. So we shouldn't forget that when The Wiz opened on Broadway, not only was it making a statement about the importance of the other American songbook, it was also causing this piece of genius art, the wonderful Wizard of Oz. It was causing it to belong to everybody, not just the Judy Garlands of the world, not just the white girls of the world, because the message is universal. The message being, there's no place like home. That's the same message that Paulo Coelho writes in The Alchemist, which has changed generations of lives. It's the same message. There's no place like home. That's where you'll find your path, your destiny. And it argues against that whole concept that the grass is always greener on the other side of the fence. And now that we're dealing so deeply with the concept of otherism, I'm proud to have been part of the revolution that changed that on Broadway, at least.
And right now, you're working on Seven Guitars, August Wilson's Seven Guitars.
Another revolution in my life, yes, I'm working on Seven Guitars, which, again, brought a bolt of lightning into an interview that I was doing and brought to fore some information that I needed to have in order to get through this process. And we'll get to that after we have a little afternoon delight. Now, I had mentioned that there were two interviews that I'd done last week, and each of them unfolded into a magical moment for me personally. We already discussed the instance of the Wiz. Mm-hmm. That was the second of the two interviews. The first interview was earlier in that week with Kyle Miner of the New Haven Register. As any interviewer worth his salt would have asked me to do, is to describe what the play is about, Seven Guitars. I answered something to this effect. If ever there were a lost tribe, a lost civilization, a lost nation, a lost culture, it is the so-called African American. Now, why do I say that? To my knowledge, every sovereign culture has a golden era. What do I mean? For instance, the Greeks, to which we attribute almost all of the human progress in the Western Hemisphere. We think it started in Greece, but that's another conversation. But the Greeks had Mount Olympus, for instance. The gods lived among the people. The Romans had their thousand-year world domination. The Egyptians had their pyramids, etc. The African American's golden age is slavery. Do you know about the Sankofa bird? Yes? It's African mythology. It's the bird of knowledge that walks in a very certain direct path forward. But its view, its beak, looks over the shoulder. The idea being, you can't know where you're going unless you know where you're coming from. Now, how appropriate it is for the descendants of the African diaspora, who are dispersed all over the planet. But even Africa doesn't claim us. Africa is still roiling under the boot of European colonialism itself. So when the African American looks over his shoulder at the beginning of his history, it's slavery. That's where the African American history started. And because of that, we are strangers in a strange land, and we are considered the wretched of the earth. And we have wandered longer than the Hebrew tribes did to get from Egypt to the land of Canaan. They were in the desert for 40 years. Our desert has lasted 400 years, and we are still wandering. The first August Wilson play I performed in was King Henry II with Timothy Douglas. This was at Arena Stage in Washington. I played Stool Pigeon, who is the Cainwell character in Seven Guitars. Stool Pigeon has the opening monologue. It goes something like this. Times ain't nothing like they used to be. The people are wandering all over the place. They got lost. They don't even know the story of how they got from tipped to tap. Now that's King Henry II, but that's applicable to the entire Pittsburgh cycle. Every one of the 10 plays in the Wilsonian canon, every play is about the lost people, how they've lost their way, how they don't know their own story because of the chasm, if you will, known as the Middle Passage. Once we were kidnapped from the west coast of Africa and brought to the so-called New World, the African did something which I believe is totally unique in the history of humanity. Now, we all know in all cultures throughout history, all people in some way or another have experienced a kind of slavery because the rule of engaging is to the victor goes the spoils. So when Greece defeated Troy, right, their prisoners became the slaves of Greece, etc. But what's unique about the Black African slave is that once brought to the New World, in a single generation, we learned and adopted a new language, a new culture, a new religion, a new way of life. Now, I say a new way of life different from those other categories because some of these individuals who were kidnapped were kings and queens who even in Africa had slaves. But the royalty that came from Africa didn't know anything about chopping sugarcane or tobacco or picking cotton 16, 18 hours a day, working from sunup to sundown. being subjected to the lash, rape, etc. So this is a kind of post-traumatic stress disorder that has tainted generations of the African in the North American continent. Now, we all know that when there is a traumatic phenomenon in America today, we'll take the Columbine. Do you remember Columbine? We'll take the Columbine incident for an example. So the first thing that's done, correctly so, you send in the militia to tamp down the violence in the situation. The second thing that happens, though, from my point of view, is that a cadre of psychologists are sent in whose purpose it is to explain to the victims that this is not your fault. This event, this traumatic event, is not your fault. You are not responsible for it. You are the victim, and we are here to start the healing process. Because in modern analytical psychology, we now understand that trauma, like genes, can be passed from one generation to the next. So we want to stop it before it starts. Now, expand that to the level of the African slave in America for 400 years. There's never been a cadre of psychologists sent to us to say, we want you to understand that you are the victim. This is not your fault. You're not responsible for this. And we're here to begin the healing process so that you do not pass this on to generations after you. That has never happened in the history of the United States of America. Not any one of the 45 presidents, including Barack Obama, has made that an issue on the campaign trail, and after winning the White House, made it an issue of his administration. So no wonder the people are wandering all over the place. No wonder the people are still lost. No wonder the people don't know the story of how they got from tit to tat. Because we are still reacting to the post-traumatic stress dysfunction, disorder. Now, maybe that sounds incredulous, but then you have to wonder why the perception of violence in America is young, male, and black. You have to wonder why the perception of welfare in America is young, female, and black. You have to wonder why prison recidivism is 90% mature, male, and black. That's not because we are evil incarnate. It's because the traumatic experience we have had for 400 years being slaves has never been alleviated, has never been healed.
And there's also an institutional aspect, an institutional racism, an institutional, yes, that allows us, combined with what you're saying, to fall into those traps, right?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
To the point that we are now self-loathing. We are our own worst enemies now. This is the situation that I believe August Wilson deals with in each of his 10 plays. In Seven Guitars, I'm playing Headley. Headley is the spirit twin of Stool Pigeon, whom I played in King Headley II. Now, I say the spirit twin because those two individuals in those separate plays act as the keeper of the oral history. They act as the indicator, the reminder of where we have been. And using that information, we have to discern where we are going. And the supernatural quality of that kind of discernment necessarily means these characters are occult. Do you catch what I mean? Occult in the sense that they are divining this information, because the information isn't written down anywhere. Our history has been written by our oppressor, not by us. That's what we have to correct. But we depend on those griots who know the oral history to keep us on the righteous path, the path of redemption, the path of atonement, the path of union. When I was first introduced to August Wilson, when I saw Fences in the late 80s, he was making his mark. But he wasn't launched as the iconic prescient prophet that he is now respected as until 1996, when at Princeton, I do believe, he introduced his treatise, his manifesto, The Ground Upon Which I Stand. When I finally read the entire manifesto, I was struck most by an early admission in the writing by August that he had been weaned on the ancient tragedians, for instance, Sophocles, Aeschylus, etc. But in terms of contemporary writing, he was very much influenced by the black militant movement of the 60s. So now I'm beginning to see a parallel between him and me. August was born in 45. I was born in 46. So with a matter of a few months, we were the same age. When August died in 2005, I was turning 60. And then when the Virginia Theater was christened the August Wilson, the first and still the only Broadway theater that has ever had the namesake of a black person, I was there for the ritual. And all this while, I'm trying to figure out why, if August and I are the same age, living through the same body politic, if you will, and coming from very similar cities, Pittsburgh for August, Baltimore, Maryland for myself, both steel towns that went bust and then had to rediscover themselves. Why am I not represented in his cycle, in his canon, in his writing? Now, when I say I, I don't mean why isn't Andre DeShields represented. But when I finally, at the age of 60, because a friend of mine sent me the box set of the August Pittsburgh cycle, and when I was finally able to read them, having seen them first, I started to wonder about this knighthood that had been bestowed upon him as the voice of Black America for the entire 20th century. When I didn't find any clues, for instance, I didn't hear the voice of Carter G. Woodson. I didn't hear the voice of W.E.B. Du Bois. I didn't hear the voice of George Washington Carver. I didn't hear the voice of Booker T. Washington. I didn't hear the voice of Langston Hughes, nor Elaine Locke. I didn't hear the voice of James Baldwin. I didn't hear the voice of the gentleman who was the architect of the March on Washington for Dr. Martin Luther King, Bayard Rustin. I didn't hear the voice of Bayard Rustin. So there were so many voices that I didn't hear that I'm beginning to think this is if not deliberate, it is certain exclude omission. So is the writing of August Wilson as exclusive in terms of omitting me as the writing of Eugene O'Neill, with the exception of the Emperor Jones? Now, to answer that question, I have to go back to another manifesto, which I got the clue from when August says he was very much influenced by the writings of the Black militant movement in the 60s. The Bible of that movement was Eldridge Cleaver, and his manifesto was called Soul on Ice. So I went back to Soul on Ice to find another avenue to August Wilson. One of the difficult conditions of being a Black militant in the United States of America back in the 60s was this group of five taboos, if you will. Obviously, Black militancy was against, generally, the white oppressor. But it also had a disdain for the Black woman. For obvious reasons, because the history of slavery is the desire for the Black woman and the emasculation of the Black man. Which is why we have that curious dichotomy today of the strong Black woman and the not so strong Black male. So generally the white oppressor, the Black woman, the Black entertainer, because he was considered to be a Tom, the Black athlete, because he was considered just a tool of the a puppet of the white oppressor, and the black homosexual male, who in that entire group was really the bottom rung, the scum of the earth. And this is not perception. This is not guessing. This is in, on the page, in Eldridge Cleaver's Black Militant Manifesto, Soul on Ice. I read it. I bet a dollar to a donut that August Wilson read it. And now I'm wondering, is there residue of this in the Pittsburgh Cycle? Because of the two genders that are treated, the women have much less agency than the men. And the men are all righteously angry and self-destructive. So this is the rock, if you will, that I, as Sisyphus, has brought to this experience and is rolling, pushing up the hill. And we all know what happens. Sisyphus gets the rock to the top of the hill, and then it just rolls down the other side. So Sisyphus has to go to the other side, push it back up, it rolls. So that's where I'm at right now. I'm pushing this rock up the hill. It hasn't rolled down the other side yet because I haven't gotten to the summit. So inside of me is roiling this contradiction, this discrepancy, this dichotomy. The question being, if August Wilson is indeed the voice of Black America throughout the 20th century, why have I been omitted? The answer to the question is, you have to go through it to get to it. And that's what I'm doing now. I'm in it. And it comes at exactly the right time for me. I'm working my way through it, I'm figuring it out, I'm getting some answers.
Why is this the right time for you?
Because of my life experience, I'm at peace with who I am. I don't apologize for who I am, what I have achieved. I have loved both women and men, and one is not greater than the other. They teach different things. And the part of the inability to find ourselves as a people, part of the inability for the nation of African Americans to have a ground upon which we stand, is the bias within the civilization. I don't mean to say that we must be a monolithic culture. No, of course not. If you took African Americans and lined them up in a row, on one end we would be black as night, and on the other end we'd be white as snow, and in the middle there would be every hue between. So I know we are a diverse people, but we make ourselves suffer the same injustices that are forced upon us by our enemies, by our oppressors. So that's part of the healing I'm talking about. And I'm approaching my healing from the standpoint of jump into the abyss that we know as August Wilson. Get down and dirty with it. Get into the mud and see what you come up with.